Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Trump invites congressional leaders to the White House to discuss Iran after Revolutionary Guard shoots down a U.S. drone. Iran shot down a U.S. RQ-4 Global Hawk naval surveillance drone earlier today. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps said in a statement that it targeted the drone inside Iranian airspace over the southern province of Hormozgan, next to the strategic strait of Hormuz. The U.S. Central Command confirmed the incident today, but denied that the aircraft was in Iranian airspace. What are we to make of all of this, and how dangerous is it now? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. As always, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So help me out here. Trump says the drone was over international waters and that everything has been scientifically documented. He says, let's see what happens, when he was asked about a U.S. response to the downing of this drone. But he also said, there is a new wrinkle. This is a new fly in the ointment. What happened, shooting down the drone, and this country will not stand for it. But then he said, but I have a feeling that it was a mistake made by somebody who he suggested was acting without orders from Iran's leadership. I'm not just talking about the country made a mistake. I'm talking about somebody under the command of that country made a mistake. I find it hard to believe it was intentional. Daniel, help me out, man. I don't get it.
It's a nightmare. It's really a nightmare. First of all, number one, that America is going to war. I don't know if it'll happen tomorrow, it will happen on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, in July, August 2019, 2020, but the handwriting is on the wall. The U.S. is on a collision course with Iran, and there is going to be a conflict. That is clear. And how it comes about, I don't know. And whether this is the lit match that explodes the powder room, I don't know. But it's certainly possible what it is. U.S. behavior is outrageous. It's reckless. It's aggressive. It's bullying. Iran has done nothing wrong at all. All it did was abide by a nuclear accord, which the U.S. negotiated, and everybody pronounced themselves happy with, and was working. It was doing what it was supposed to do. Now, Trump has essentially busted it up, created a casus belli out of nothing, and it seems that some kind of conflict is impending. Now, as to where this drone was, I mean, I'm inclined to believe the Iranians, because the U.S., you know, record, honesty, record kind of stuff is abysmal, but I don't know for sure. To me, what's especially interesting is that this drone, $130 million drone, contained advanced anti-missile devices that were supposed to protect it against a shoot-down of this sort. Well, they didn't work very well, did they? So therefore, the U.S. is more vulnerable, and or Iran has greater capabilities than the U.S. realizes. So what that means is the U.S. could be stumbling into something very, very bad, very bloody, which could cause the entire region to explode from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean. It will not be a pretty picture. Yet the U.S. is behaving in the most reckless manner possible. And by the way, the Iranian government has made it quite clear that it was not a mistake by some underling, that this was official policy. They shot down the drone because they say it was in their airspace.
That point right there, I was going to quickly get to that in terms of Trump saying somebody made a mistake. No, the government issued a statement saying, we shot down your drone. It didn't say, please excuse us, we inadvertently shot down your drone. They didn't say, oh, a drunken general shot down your drone. We shot down your drone and we don't want war, but if you bring it, we're ready.
There's going to be a war. There is going to be a war. It's horrible to say, but there is going to be a war.
You were saying that you weren't sure how it was going to escalate. I was watching one of the shows today. General Spider Marks said that most likely the United States will have a surgical missile strike on the missile battery that shot down the drone. And one of the commentators said, well, that won't be good. And he just looked in the camera and said, but this is probably what we're going to do.
It's really unbelievable. It's really scary. Yes, they're an automatic pilot. They are careening towards a confrontation. They're careening towards disaster. It is this is like a 1914 moment all over again, and it could be catastrophic. I mean, you know, a surgical strike. That word surgical strike is ridiculous.
Right.
But let's even assume that's what it is. You know, Iran is in no mood to take this lying down. And there are plenty of U.S. shipping, commercial and naval, within striking distance of Iranian missiles. So if Iran wishes it to, if the U.S. escalates, Iran will very possibly escalate as well. And then you have a forest fire.
You know, you've said this a couple of times, and I want to unpack it a little bit because I don't know that people really understand what you mean. The wheels are in motion. America is going to war. And when you said that, it made me think about Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And I had heard from a number of sources that a couple of weeks or maybe a week before George Bush pushed the button, Saddam Hussein sent a message to George Bush saying, don't invade my country and we can work this out. I'll do what you want me to do, but don't invade my country. And the response was, sorry, but we're already on our way.
Yeah.
And this was weeks before, a couple of weeks before Shock and Awe was launched. But basically he was saying, the wheels are turning. Dude, you're done. So if you could, I wanted people to understand what you really mean when you say we're going to war, because what I take away from what you're saying is it's already on.
Yes. The wheels are in motion. And the forces are colliding. The exact timing is impossible to predict. This could be the incident. We don't know. The Trump could back off yet again. We don't know. But the overall trend is clear, and that is the U.S. is moving towards some kind of confrontation with Iran. And what I think your listeners should understand is it's not just the Persian Gulf. It's not just the Strait of Hormuz. It also involves Iraq, it involves Syria, it involves Lebanon, and it involves Israel, and it involves Saudi Arabia, far and away the weakest regime in that entire region. And if war comes, there's my prediction, the Saudi regime will collapse. And they just won't. And by that, I don't mean that they'll put someone in to take MBS's place, Mohammed bin Salman, the murderous crown prince. What I mean is that the House of Saud will collapse and the country will collapse into chaos.
Why will this be the precipitant to the collapse of the House of Saud?
Because first of all, number one, they're within striking distance of Iranian missiles. Number one. Number two, the government is the most incompetent on the face of the earth. They are losing to a ragtag militia known as the Houthis in Yemen, who are beating the pants off them. The country is profoundly corrupt. The Saudi military is a joke. They have, you know, they're filled with, you know, hotshot F-16 pilots, but not a foot soldier worth his salt, because nobody wants to fight and die for the House of Saud.
Gotcha.
It's just the weakest, the most dangerous regime on earth. And Mohammed bin Salman himself is completely isolated. You know, he's locked in his palace, you know, afraid of assassins, afraid of rogue military units. And what war does, the war strains the country's resources.
Right.
You know, it puts it to the test. It strains it. And Saudi Arabia is just like, you know, is just the most, in the most fragile state. So that any strain, I think, will cause it to collapse.
Let me ask you this, because if we look at this historically, we have a president who's been saber-rattling and all this jingoistic language, but when the drone gets shot down, he says, there wasn't a pilot there. There wasn't a pilot in the drone. If there had been, oh, this would be a whole different issue. But there wasn't a pilot. Basically, he's saying, hey, folks, pump your brakes. Instead of saying, oh, somebody get the Ayatollah on the phone because I'm coming after him now. It seems as though right in the middle of when you would expect Donald Trump to be standing on his desk, screaming and pulling out his hair, shooting rounds into the ceiling, all of a sudden now he wants to try to come across as being slightly more reasonable.
Yes, but whether the U.S. plunges ahead, with all its faculties, or merely tumbles head forward, it'll wind up in war. And by the way, let me just add something else. You know, not only is the Saudi regime fragile, but the American regime is fragile.
Absolutely.
I mean, you have an unelected president, you have the country split down the middle, you have bitter economic polarization. I mean.
But here's the thing, to that point, and you take me right to my next question. It's interesting to me, but not surprising, but interesting that U.S. corporate media is presenting this as though there is no history of the Gulf of Tonkin, of the sinking of the Maine, of weapons. Where are the weapons of mass destruction? I would still like for somebody to please show me where the weapons of mass destruction are. So it's as though we don't have a history of these false flag operations. Last week, they were telling us that while Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was sitting in a meeting with Ayatollah Khomeini in Tehran, that the Iranians just decided to shoot at a tanker.
A Japanese-owned tanker. How do you explain that?
But I don't hear the voices in the media being a calming effect and a voice of reason. I hear them fanning the flames of the jingoism, which I would expect would be the counter to the wheels being in motion.
And it's worse than that. Bear in mind that last month, 400 members of Congress, including Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, signed a letter to Trump calling on him to get tough, if you can believe it, get tough with Iran.
There you go.
I mean, 400 members of Congress, you know, two major Democratic presidential candidates calling on Trump to get tough of all godforsaken things.
It's as though Cory Booker and Kamala Harris know nothing about the Office of Special Programs and how that office was set up to intentionally skew the data so that the media would have a basis upon which to say there are weapons of mass destruction, there was yellow cake uranium bought from Niger, and Saddam Hussein is going to lunch with what's his name in the cave in Tora Bora.
They don't care. They just don't care. They just don't care. They're playing politics in the worst sense of the term. You know, I mean, they just don't care. American political leadership is so bankrupt, and the gap between Washington and the rest of the country is so enormous. I mean, who's going to fight and die in these wars?
They just sent 1,000 guys and gals, or are in the process of sending 1,000 guys and gals. They got 1,000 over there.
Yeah. I feel sorry for those poor men and women.
But to your point, because we no longer have a draft, the disconnect between those that are sent and those that are not, because, for example, I don't know anybody that's on their way over there. Whereas if we had a draft, the likelihood of my saying, you know, I know some people whose sons, or I know some folks whose dads are. But now there is such a disconnect also between the members of Congress and those that are being sent to fight. They don't know anybody that's doing it.
In some ways, abolishing the draft is one of the worst things this country ever did. Because if there was a draft, None of these wars in the last 25 years would have been fought. American moms and dads would have been in the streets saying, you know, over my dead body. I guarantee. It's insane. But this is finally, I mean, it's clear what's going to happen. I mean, you're going to see collision with a country of 70 million people. The regime is relatively strong. They have allies across the region. And it's going to ignite a sectarian war, by the way, which will be disastrous. You know who the real winner will be in this war? That will be Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
You know, if you follow the stereotypes that have been portrayed in the media, who would have thought that the Iranians would be the more measured and the more adult and the more thoughtful entity in this conflict? Because they shot down a drone. I'll bet your house on this that they knew we're shooting down a drone. We're not killing people. We're just going to cost the American government $1.9 million or whatever the heck, whatever those things cost.
$130 million. Yeah. That's a lot of money.
Up to this point, they've been very, very much more measured in not responding to the provocations of the Trump administration.
Iran is taking real punishment.
Right.
The sanctions the U.S. has imposed are hitting it hard.
Yes.
They're suffering. Their economy is reeling. So it's not merely been a question of verbal insults. They are taking, blows to the body.
We got to get out here, and here's the final point. For what? What is the Trump agenda plan? What is when? That has not been articulated. Basically, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there.
It's to make the Middle East safer.
Oh.
The UAE,
okay.
Saudi Arabia,
oh.
And that's what the U.S. is doing.
Thank you, Daniel. I appreciate that clarification. All right, folks. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. House passes a almost $1 trillion spending bill as budget talks resume. The Democratic-controlled House passed a $1 trillion spending bill yesterday that amounts to what some describe as an opening bid in a guns versus butter fight with the Trump administration. The measure far exceeds Trump's budget request for domestic programs, attracting a White House veto threat, but denies him his full Pentagon budget increase. That denial of his full budget increase includes $733 billion for the Pentagon, which is up from $716 billion from the previous year, but the president demanded $750 billion. What are we to make of this? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He is a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, as always, welcome back.
Always glad to be here.
So when you read the reports of the House passing this spending bill, the first thing that jumped out at me was the military, the Pentagon side of this, because the Democrats want to always portray themselves as being the peace seekers in the world, the tree huggers and the doves in the conversation. But their increase to $733 billion for the Pentagon just sounds to me as though they're going along with the overarching concept or construct of American foreign policy and American interventionalism.
Well, you know, my comment on that is it's a repeat of the deal that the Democrats have been striking for the last couple of years, and that is to maintain social program spending, pretty much, just adjusting for inflation, agree to increases in the military budget. You know, the $733 billion is just the immediate Pentagon budget. Mm-hmm. That's not the military budget. Let me explain that, right? First of all, that does not include what's called overseas contingency operations, OCOs, where there is a direct military conflict like there has been going in Afghanistan. That's all in addition to the Pentagon budget. And, of course, what's happening with Iran now, sending 1,000 troops and who knows what support, and I'm sure that's going to ratchet up, that will be an OCO operation. That will be in addition to the $733 billion. Plus, you got to figure in somewhere around $75 billion a year in what's called off-budget black projects. That does not get into print anywhere as part of the budget. You know, that's for the new super-secret weapons systems that are being developed, and only the military and the leaders in the House and Senate and the heads of the military defense committees know what that is. That amount was $50 to $70 billion a decade ago. No one knows what it is now, but probably higher. That doesn't show up into $733 billion. Plus, I'm not through yet. all the oil and gasoline used by the military for aircraft and ships and everything, that's not in the Pentagon budget. That's in the Energy Department budget. So is all the development of new tactical nuclear weapons going on. That's in the Atomic Energy budget. Then you got the Veterans Administration and the nice pensions that the generals and admirals get and health care for vets. The subsidizing of housing and education and job retraining for vets who return. What is the budget being used here by the NSA, National Security Administration, the CIA, and the State Department for their special ops military mercenary private arms? We don't know what that is, but that's in their budget. And then part of the Homeland Security should also be understood as part of the defense budget, military budget as well. When you add up all of these sources, the Pentagon budget is only like 3/4 of the total. It's easily $1 trillion a year and rising under Trump, who projects at least $100 billion a year increases going out for who knows how long he's in office. So this is the real expenditures going on for the military. Military budget is not just the Pentagon budget. And, of course, the Democrats are complicit in all this because in order to maintain, as I said at the beginning, social program spending, they agree and negotiate increases in this military budget. It's running amok. And it's bleeding everybody because this really doesn't add much to the U.S. economy anymore.
So now, taking off your economist hat and putting on your political hat, as we're moving towards 2020, is it that the Democrats don't want to really push back on the Pentagon side because they see that not portending well for them politically? Is it that they honestly believe that this is the direction that we need to go? Or, as I believe, they would be much better served explaining to the American people, to a great degree, what you've just articulated. And we'll get into the comments by Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib in just a minute. But explaining to the American people that this does not bode well for the American economy.
Well, it depends what Democrats you're talking about. You know, the moneybag Democrats, as I call them, the old DLCers who still run the Democratic Party and are tied in, you know, with Schumer and Pelosi here. They're big funders of the Democrats. And there are certain districts that are Democratic that depend upon defense spending significantly. They're not going to buck this at all. And what progressive Democrats you might have who don't have a stake with big companies in their district that contribute to their campaigns significantly, they're, you know, not so interested in this, because the fact is military spending does not have the same, as we economists say, multiplier effect that it used to have. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. World War II, you could build a fighter, P-51 fighter aircraft for $50,000, and they built tens of thousands of these aircraft. Today, to build, you know, an F-35, it's tens of million, maybe $100 million. And a lot of that development and production is farmed out, you know, to Japan, to Europe, and so forth. They all build pieces and so forth of it in order to tie them into buying contracts and buying some of these aircraft. So it's not really, and Raytheon and their missiles, these are high-tech, high, you know, it's not really production-oriented. So the more we spend on military, direct military, particularly weapon systems, the lower multiplier effect it has, and therefore the less impact it has on GDP. Military spending does not have the boost to the economy it used to have, and yet it's rising, rising, rising.
We deserve better than to come second to for-profit defense spending that doesn't make our nation any safer. These are huge checks being written to Boeing and Lockheed Martin, when we should be cutting checks to everyday people struggling to make ends meet, said Representative Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, one of just seven Democrats to vote against the trillion-dollar spending measure. And she was talking about Boeing, and today we're in the second day of congressional hearings about the 737 MAX, and Daniel Carey, the president of the Allied Pilots Association, a union representing American Airlines pilots, said that Boeing has caused a global aviation crisis of trust. These crashes are demonstrable evidence that our current system of aircraft design and certification has failed us. Chelsea Sully Sullenberger said these crashes are demonstrable evidence that our current system of aircraft design and certification has failed us. Other witnesses said that the design of the anti-stall system was flawed from the beginning and the crash could easily happen within the United States. I bring this up in this context because here you have Rashida Tlaib talking about huge checks being written to Boeing, while in another House office building, we're having hearings on Boeing and their safety. Now, I understand that there's a civilian aircraft side of Boeing and that there is a defense aircraft side of Boeing, but it seems as though a lot of this money is going a very long way in keeping Boeing afloat.
Well, Boeing, I believe, is one of the examples of a number of scores of companies that were super profitable, I mean, big profits, and they not only did not pay taxes under the Trump tax cuts, we actually wrote them and their similar subsidized companies $79 billion here just last year. The government taxes we paid were distributed to these super profitable companies like Boeing and others, to the tune of $79 billion. That's just the Fortune 500, by the way. Who knows whatever how much checks were written for these other players, you know? So, you know, the tax system is a mess, and so is the regulatory system. What you've got here is big corporations, whether defense or non-defense, who have captured all these regulatory agencies, and these regulators are in bed with them. And that's true under Obama, as it is even more so under Trump. Mm-hmm. And they're doing whatever the companies want. And what you get is Boeing rushing the 737 to a market here to compete with Airbus. And you get problems that result in crashed aircraft. But it's not just the FAA and it's not just Boeing. This is going on everywhere. All these agencies, energy agency and even the Federal Reserve, revolving doors going on, right? You go to work, you come out of the banking industry, you go to work for the Fed, right? Or you become a district president out of the banking industry in one of the Fed districts, and then you decide on interest rate cuts that benefit the financial sector and the financial markets. I mean, look at what just happened here. The Fed a couple of days ago just announced, well, it signals they're going to lower rates. And what happens to the stock market? It goes through the roof, and the bond market goes through the roof, right? Subsidizing. We're subsidizing these big banks and finance companies and organizations, financial organizations, more and more. That's what the government does. It subsidizes through the tax system. It subsidizes through the monetary system, these big corporations who are just gouging us in every way, shape, and form, and people don't realize it. The most blatant example, of course, is the military budget, but that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Your explanation there just made me reflect upon, you know, one of the big problems that we heard about in terms of this Boeing issue was that the FAA does not have the engineers on staff to do the type of inspection and research that needed to be done to be sure, for example, that the 737 MAX was airworthy and that its design and systems were functional. And so they relied on Boeing engineers to do the self-certification. And this makes me want to ask you this. This takes me back to the Clinton idea of remaking government as we know it and the whole idea that Al Gore came up with about greater privatization, trying to make the government function more like the private sector. And so can we trace a lot of these problems of not having enough food inspectors, not having enough FAA aircraft engineers and inspectors? Can we trace a lot of this back to the slimming down, the cutting back of government that we take back to the Clinton-Gore administration and trying to remake government as we know it?
I would take it back at least to the Reagan administration. That's where it all begins. This is where all the cutting of government spending, cutting of
absolutely.
Whatever, to make up for the budget deficits that were created, were being created by tax cuts for corporations and investors and increased military spending. They always try, this is what's called supply side theory, they always try to offset the budget deficits created by excess military spending and tax cuts by cutting social programs, and that includes cutting inspectors and all the other, you know, whether it's health and safety or food safety or whatever. It's all about cutting all that down. I mean, right now in the environmental department, you got virtually no inspection going on whatsoever. This is all part of corporate elites capturing the government. The government is not no longer even a partial arbiter between the various sectors of society, not just the rich and their corporations, but it's just a vehicle on behalf of the super rich and the big corporations. It's just a vehicle to shuffle the money around and redistribute it to them in terms of tax cuts and low interest rates and all the other means, subsidies, writing checks and so forth. That's what's going on more and more. The government is a big source of subsidy for big corporate America now.
You know, the reason I took it back to Clinton, and I do realize that Clinton got it from Ronald Reagan, but it was that report that Al Gore published as Clinton's vice president, Remaking Government as We Know It, which is where he clearly articulated and started using that language of making government function more like the private sector. And so that's why I took it back to the Clinton administration.
Right. Well, the comment on that, you know, the Clinton administration represents the takeover of money bags and investors of the Democratic Party.
The DLC.
Yeah, the DLC. They were a faction, and Clinton was their boy, and they won out. In fact, they won out so totally, they are the leadership now, and they disbanded as a faction within the Democratic Party. And, you know, as I said, Clinton was their boy, Gore is their boy, Obama was their boy, and whoever comes next will probably, if it's Biden, is their boy, and they run the show, and their whole idea in the late 80s was, oh, well, we got to act like the Republicans,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
We got to go for privatization, free markets. You know, we got to open it all up to the markets, let the markets decide and run everything. That's what neoliberalism is all about, let the markets decide. Well, you see what happens when you let the markets decide. They gave us the 2008-09 crash and this lopsided recovery ever since then, where owners of capital incomes have padded their wallets incredibly, $1 trillion, $1.3 trillion a year now being distributed just by the Fortune 500 companies in the form of stock buybacks and dividend payouts. $1.3 trillion a year now going up every year. This is why we have this growing income inequality, while wages don't really grow. They say they're growing, but wages really aren't rising for about 80% of the people. Maybe for the top 20%, they're rising. But the data and the statistics they use are all biased and skewed to show how really the average is rising, but that's all going to the high end. So no wages really growing for most of the folks here. Jobs being created are part-time, contingent, temp jobs, gig jobs. And the rich are just handing themselves through the government huge amounts of payoffs going left and right. And that's true whether you got a Democratic Party or Republican Party. We don't have two parties anymore. We have a corporate party of America with two wings.
In wrapping this up, and we have just about a minute and a half left, I want to go back to part of Rashida Tlaib's statement. We should be cutting checks to everyday people struggling to make ends meet. That, to me, right there, would be an incredible message for the Democratic Party to latch onto and to tap into and to demonstrate how, by using some of this Pentagon money to go back into the pockets of working class and poor people in this country, that, to me, could be a hell of a platform that the Democrats could rally around and build substantive policy around. Is that pie in the sky wishful thinking on my part?
Well, I agree with you, and that represents that small progressive wing of the Democratic Party who still believe that you can perhaps move the party in that direction. You know, I support their program. I support what they're saying. They're good people and everything. But I'm telling you that that party, like the Republicans, is controlled by the money bags, and they'll never allow that kind of a program.
And so just to quickly wrap this up, this is, of course, the beginning of budget talks resuming. Do you see a government shutdown on the horizon? And let me just quickly say, we're now starting to read in the paper about the economic slowdown that you've been talking about for about the last 8 months. With that, I just wanted to quickly give you a shout out and give you credit on that. Do you see another shutdown on the horizon? Do you see an intractable argument between the Democrats and the Republicans as it centers around this budget?
No, because what you got is a repeat now of that same formula the Democrat leadership and the Republicans have worked out. And that is, we'll give you more military spending, just don't cut and give us some token increases in the social program spending. And we'll both agree and we'll get the debt ceiling raised. No, there's not going to be any shutdown at all anymore here because both sides are in agreement on this particular solution. And we are generating a trillion plus deficits every year being added to the $22 trillion we have now in the national debt, another $4 trillion in state and local debt, another $4 trillion, $4 to $5 trillion in central bank and so forth debt. We've got $30 trillion, and the projections by the Congressional Budget Office is that the national deficit is going to go from, our debt is going to go from $22 trillion to $34 trillion by 2028. And we're going to be paying $900 billion a year just in interest every year on that.
That's frightening. Dr. Jack Rasmus, thank you as always for your contribution and look forward to having you back.
Always glad to be.
Thank you, sir. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, China's President Xi Jinping arrived in North Korea today to hold talks with their leader Kim Jong-un before the G20 summit, while President Trump and Canadian President Prime Minister Trudeau discussed the North American trade deal in what I believe is in the context of the trade war with China. Chinese President Xi Jinping arrived in North Korea today for a historic summit with Kim Jong-un, becoming the first Chinese leader to travel to the country in 14 years. His two-day trip comes days before President Xi is scheduled to meet with President Trump during a Group of 20 summit, or the G20 summit, in Japan. Is this a pregame strategy between Xi and Kim before the Xi and Trump meeting? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is a brilliant historian who currently holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History in African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's one of our most prolific writers, and his latest book is White Supremacy Confronted, U.S. Imperialism and Anti-Communism versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rhodes to Mandela, Dr. Gerald Horn. As always, Gerald, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for inviting me.
So as we look at Chinese President Xi arriving in North Korea again, the first time in 14 years that a Chinese president has made such a visit, it's no accident that this comes days before the G20 summit. Your thoughts, sir?
Even though the mainstream media is spinning this get-together between President Xi and Chairman Kim as some sort of attempt by the Chinese to get the North Koreans to come to an agreement with President Trump, I'm not so sure about that. It may be a reflection of the fact that China sees this trade war launched by Mr. Trump in May 2019 as being very serious. And in fact, it is very serious. China might have paid attention to the fact that these massive demonstrations in Hong Kong, the special administrative region of the People's Republic of China, were commented upon quite a bit by the White House and by U.S. administration officials. They may see this upcoming impending massive arms sales to Taiwan, the rebel province off the coast of China, which China claims. They may see all of this as part of a concentrated clampdown on Beijing, the world's second largest economy and the most populous nation on planet Earth with 1.4 billion people. And so this may be leading President Xi to try to remove the possibility that North Korea could be used as some sort of lever against China, which I think was the idea of some within the Trump White House, and that this may lead to a kind of consolidation amongst the communist and socialist forces, which, of course, have been fragmented, as you know, for decades now. That's one possible reading, and I think it may be the most apt reading.
To your point, it was in the Washington Post that Xi has the power to bring Kim back to the negotiating table, which will be welcomed by Trump. This was according to Park Byung-Kwang, a researcher at the Institute for National Security Strategy in Seoul, Korea, as though President Xi is operating on behalf of Trump the way that many thought the president of Japan was trying to broach a backdoor channel between the U.S. and Iran. This reading here, just to me, doesn't make that much sense.
Well, it's a terribly U.S.-centric view of the world. That is to say, a view perhaps more appropriate for the early 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when the United States was being touted as the indispensable nation, as the sole remaining superpower, the uber power, as Paris once put it. But I think those days are long gone. I think that the emerging view is that Mr. Trump, personally, kind of Twitter tiger, a 21st century version of the paper tiger that the Beijing leadership used to affix to the U.S. leadership back in the bad old days of the war against Vietnam. And I think that with this alleged attack by the Iranians on a U.S. drone, and the fact that at least thus far, there's just been the usual sort of fire and fury rhetoric coming out of Washington, I think that the Chinese might feel that they are beginning to have some sort of leverage over the White House in light of this trade war. And I might also say that you mentioned in your introductory remarks the visit of Prime Minister Trudeau to Washington as
yes.
well.
Uh-huh.
And I would really urge Justin Trudeau to take a very sober view of what's happening in the world right now. Mr. Trudeau does not have very good relations with China. In fact, a Canadian vessel was just sailing off the coast of China, apparently close to Taiwan, which was not pleasing to Beijing. Mr. Trudeau takes a traditional Cold War view towards Moscow. And as you know, just last year, Mr. Trump was denouncing Justin Trudeau in no uncertain terms. And so here you have this massive, at least in terms of territory, country, that is China, with a population of only 37 million, with bad relations with three of the major powers, this puts him in a disadvantageous position when he comes to the White House. It's been a staple of the United States ever since it came into existence in 250 years ago, that Canadian territory rightfully should belong to the United States of America. That was the import of the War of 1812, that is to say, the United States trying to take over Canada. Perhaps the United States does not want to take over Canada in terms of making it the 51st state, but certainly I think that forcing Mr. Trudeau to bow down and sign disadvantageous trade deals and to further knuckle under to Mr. Trump with regard to this NAFTA Part 2, the U.S.-Mexican Free Trade Agreement, Mr. Trudeau needs to be very careful if he wants to emerge with his politics and his sanity intact after this confrontation with Mr. Trump.
It's reported that when Trump was asked about the two Canadians being detained in China after the arrest in Canada of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou on U.S. charges, Trump said he would do anything to help. If Trudeau asked him, Trump said he would raise the detentions with Xi Jinping when they meet in Japan at the G20. The whole thing started with the United States asking Canada to arrest and extradite Meng Wanzhou. This sounds once again like Donald Trump creating a conflict and then asking or acting as though he doesn't know what to do.
Well, I'm afraid you're right. I'm in the midst of going through Michael Wolff's latest book, Siege, which deals with Trump in the White House. Recall, he's the best-selling author of last year's Fire and Fury. And obviously, he's relying on anonymous sources, although it's clear that Steve Bannon, the now defrocked advisor to Mr. Trump, the alleged mastermind of Mr. Trump's victory, is a major source. But if only a half of what he says in this book is accurate, and I dare say that it's probably more, then we are in real trouble, because he questions Mr. Trump's mental stability. Obviously, he questions his ethics. And obviously, he questions his ability to avoid a kind of crackdown on anti-Trump forces. And in that regard, I hope that all of us paid careful and close attention to the kickoff campaign rally in Orlando, Florida, just the other day, where you had ultra-rightists and fascists, including the Proud Boys, including followers of Alex Jones' InfoWars, seeking to pummel anti-Trump protesters, making chants in support of late Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, as if they would like to see a replay of Chilean fascism on these shores. And I dare say that after reading Michael Wolff's book and what I know about the United States and its history, this is a very dangerous moment. And the moment, I think, could become even more dangerous if, as I suggest, it seems that China is not going to knuckle under with regard to Mr. Trump's threats concerning trade, that China feels that it has the cards, not least because with regard to some sort of confrontation, if it comes to that, they basically see Mr. Trump as just a 21st century of a paper tiger, a Twitter tiger.
To your earlier point about Trudeau and needing to be cautious, last year when they were in Quebec for the G7 meeting, and at that point after the meeting, you know, Trump gets on Air Force One and then starts lambasting Trudeau. And then we look at the United States leaving the Iran nuclear deal, and how can anybody trust this guy? I was sitting here scratching my head when I was reading that Trudeau was today at the White House saying, man, why are you even sitting there? And how can you even think you're negotiating with this guy?
Well, that's the problem, is it not, that countries like Canada face. Not only countries like Canada, but I would say a good deal of the European Union, particularly Germany and France. That is to say, since the end of World War II, Washington, U.S. imperialism has been sort of a guarantor for all of imperialism, for the transnational corporations that are disproportionately cited in the North Atlantic community. But with the election of Mr. Trump in 2016, you see a fundamental rupture and a shift in U.S. strategy. That is to say, Mr. Trump sees these North Atlantic so-called allies as basically freeloaders and free riders. He sees them as chickens ready to be plucked. He does not see them as being militarily capable. And by the way, pay very careful and close attention to the fact that as we speak, the Germans and the French are trying to develop a fighter jet that would be comparable to the best that Lockheed Martin and Raytheon have to offer. But as of today, the Europeans and the Canadians seem to be thwarted. That is to say, they would like to think that the post-1945 agreement in terms of the United States helping to protect their interests in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, that will be protected and continue. But they have a sneaking suspicion that those days are over, that even if Mr. Trump does not do well in the November 2020 elections, that he still might be reelected. And in fact, his 63 million strong base of support is not going anywhere soon and will be influencing whoever occupies the White House. And so in some ways, it seems to me that the North Atlantic community has reached the banks of the Rubicon. That is to say, a fundamental decision has to be taken as to what direction to go in. These major powers are inherently cautious. They are trying to preserve the status quo. They would not like to see a disruption of the status quo. But with Mr. Trump's erratic nature and policies, he's forcing them to contemplate what could be for them a disastrous course to pursue.
Going back to the President Xi being in North Korea, Xi published a letter in a North Korean paper calling for a political resolution to issues on the Korean Peninsula and securing peace and stability in the region. Now, this is being interpreted as Xi is telling Kim Jong-un that Pyongyang should refrain from provocations in Washington to hold back military threats, as though, again, Xi is operating on behalf of the United States. But I see, first of all, nobody wants a conflict on the Korean Peninsula, especially China. They don't want a conflict. I would see Chinese President Xi wanting to be sure that things remain calm, but not so much for the relationship between the U.S. and China. I see China and North Korea having more in common and more to benefit than President Xi in the United States. Is that too simplistic of a point?
Not at all. And just to reiterate a point that I made a few moments ago, there's been a growing clamor amongst communist parties, both in power and out of power, for reconciliation amongst the now fragmented communist movement. Perhaps not a return to the days of the Comintern, the Communist International, the headquarters of communist parties in Moscow, which of course was disassembled during World War II, but certainly a move away from the kinds of conflict that you've not only seen over the years between North Korea and China, but you've also seen between Vietnam and China. In fact, there are rumblings in Washington that despite the predicate on which the war in Vietnam was fought, that Vietnam was some sort of cat's paw for China. Now the idea is to turn Vietnam against China. Certainly you see U.S. corporations who are trying to escape tariffs are moving in a pell-mell direction due south towards Vietnam. And so I think that this idea that President Xi is going to be a kind of puppet or a sock puppet for Mr. Trump is quite frankly ludicrous. It goes against what we know in terms of the recent meetings that have taken place between President Xi and Vladimir Putin, not only in Moscow, but in Central Asia, where the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, a counterpoint to NATO, just had a high-level summit featuring the two leaders from Moscow and Beijing. And I think it also is contrary to China's attempt to avoid and evade U.S. sanctions against Iran. It seems to me that if Mr. Xi was going to be so cooperative with Washington, we would not be having this discussion about China trying to avoid and evade sanctions against Iran, that is to say, buying Iranian oil, continuing to invest in Iran, which in fact is what's going on as we speak.
So, Gerald, here's the final question. When Kim Jong-un came to power, it was reported that he executed a number of the old guard in his government, many of whom were loyal to his father. Do you think that his removing those individuals from power was his first step towards the rethinking of the communist mindset in North Korea that you were referring to earlier?
Well, that's possible. I mean, it's hard to say. North Korea is obviously in a very difficult situation economically. It's a very difficult situation in terms of security with South Korea on its border. South Korea bristling with tens of thousands of U.S. troops right across the Sea of Japan. You have Japan, a major power, the third largest economy on planet Earth, which, by the way, despite the so-called self-defense proviso in its constitution, has been arming mightily within recent years. And we already know about all the various counterintelligence operations that are being run against North Korea that might have misled the Kim regime into moving against some of the erstwhile comrades. So it's difficult to say what's going on with regard to Pyongyang, not least because it's rather opaque in terms of trying to figure out what's actually going on. But we do know that this meeting between Chairman Kim and President Xi is probably not what's being portrayed in the mainstream U.S. media. And I think the analysis we've been discussing in recent moments is more likely to be accurate.
Well, as always, Gerald, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you always for your contribution to the Critical Hour. And let me strongly, strongly recommend folks get a hold of your latest book, White Supremacy Confronted. Fantastic, fantastic piece. And look forward to having you back.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. You have been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.